Consumer Protection will come to order. It is Thursday, March 26, 2009, and we're going to start with Senator Lynch. Senator Lynch, I think, spoke to some of the members on the committee about bringing the bill back. I think we just set it aside. We just laid it over. And I know she's going to offer an amendment. Not going to take very much testimony. I've got 10 minutes here for you, Senator Lynch, so because we have some bills that need to keep moving, too. So with that, you have Senate File 688, and I think you have an amendment.
Madam Chair, thank you. I do have the A2 amendment.
And Senator Dahl will offer the A2 amendment. Did we amend the bill the other day?
I don't think so.
So this would kind of still be an author's amendment. It's a delete everything, so it's putting the bill in the shape that Senator Lynch would like to describe for us. So all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails. Okay. So you have the amended language, Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I sincerely appreciate the invitation to come back today, so thank you very much for that. I took lots of notes when we had our earlier discussion, and it is my belief that those are reflected in the A2 amendment. I want to direct your attention to a couple of things. One, you will see that we made an effort to provide some further clarity with regard specifically to a couple of definitions, one beginning on 1.11, the other on 1.15. We had discussion in this committee about the desire that any such reimbursement rates should more properly be negotiated rather than statutorily determined. And we thought that that was good advice as well. And so you will see that that provision has been removed. We tried to tighten this up a little bit. The other thing that has happened that's not reflected in the amendment, last Thursday there was a conversation with one of the providers with regard to this request or this...
one of the providers? Senator Lynch,
I'm sorry,
one of the plans.
I said provider. One of the plans. Too much health care on the brain.
Yes.
With one of the plans, my understanding is that there will be in continued conversations. There have been and are scheduled additional conversations with other plans. What I have indicated to the groups that have I've been working with is that it is, I believe, the desire of this committee, it's the desire of the author that it would be most preferable that they would continue these conversations and work this out.
Senator Lynch, clearly, I think that was how the committee felt. I mean, it seems the results that were shared with us seemed, almost too good to be true. I mean, these really seemed very positive, and I think members were really impressed with that. We were just concerned that that the plans maybe hadn't listened or, maybe there was some other evidence that wasn't as promising. I don't know, but I think it's really good to keep the conversation going. That is what I think the members of this committee would like to see happen just based on members' response. So there just was a certain level of discomfort at saying, well, we know that this is – really a great deal. I mean, it certainly looks like it. So with that, did anybody need to testify?
No, Madam Chair. I couldn't agree with you more. It would be our desire that we would be afforded the opportunity to move forward today and move on to the Health Policy Committee, where we will continue those discussions. And I want to just reemphasize that the impetus behind all of this is healthcare reform and cost containment. And sometimes, oftentimes, those conversations, as has proven in this case, are very difficult, challenging, and hard to have. But nonetheless, it is important that we continue to move forward in this arena.
Senator Lynch, Senator Dahl, do you want to move the bill?
Yes, Madam Chair. I'll move Senate File 688 as amended.
Senator Dahl moves that Senate File 688 as amended be recommended to pass. I know that there are some people who, and it would be referred, to Health, Housing, and Family Security. I know there were some people that wanted to testify on this, Senator Lynch.
And Madam Chair, whatever your desire is, I will just note to the committee and to those in the audience, I have reason to believe that there will be that opportunity tomorrow in the Health Policy Committee. And
if anybody sees the chair, they'll be sure to share that.
Just in deference to your schedule, I just am throwing that out there.
Senator Marty.
I think my committee really wants to see those wound photos.
So, is there anybody that wishes to testify here?
Yeah.
Mr. Bartsch. And then Senator Prettner-Solin.
Madam Chair, may I just say that because we really want this not to have to be legislated, because we really want the plans to be working with the proponents, that I would like to amend Senator Dahl's legislation to say that we move this without recommendation.
Okay. That's appropriate, and I think that raises a comfort level for some people to support this. Mr. Bartsch.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Bartsch, representing Health Partners. I'll be very brief. I know the time constraints you're under. I do agree that the amendment before you has taken some of the provisions that we were concerned with out of the bill, particularly 100% of billed charges, the language on the money-back guarantee, which is also a concern, and there is an attempt to clarify the definition of formulary-based wound care. So I appreciate the author and the proponents trying to address those changes. We still have some concerns that under subsection B, formulary-based wound care, does not adequately define this product or this group, that it opens up a mandate for what would essentially be any technology FDA-approved using some of the components that they have, and that's a concern for us moving forward. While I appreciate their efforts, I just for the record again, like to state that the process that's been referenced in the last couple of weeks about contacting the health plans is the preferred way to begin this approach. Those would be the initial conversations that we would be having with them. And so they haven't yet had those. And the bill before you is legislation that circumvents the normal process of sitting down with us ahead of time, discussing new treatment modalities, and then making that decision. Madam Chair, I'll end there. The only thing I want to do is respond to a question that Senator Sparks had the last time this bill was up. He had asked us about how much we spend on wound care. It's approximately $6.5 million a year we spend to treat wounds. Be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Would anybody else? Thank you, Mr. Bartsch. Would anybody else like to speak? Seeing none. Then Senator Dahl renews his motion as amended by Senator Prettner-Solin that the bill go without recommendation, pass without recommendation and be referred to the Health, Housing, and Family Security Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign?
No.
The motion prevails. Senator Lynch, gentlemen, thank you.
Madam Chair, members, thank you.
And if we see that chair, we'll tell them when you're coming, okay? Senator Moi. Oh, there she is. Didn't see her. Senator Moi, welcome.
Can't seem to pull this, so I will try to project. Madam Chair and members, thank you for giving us an opportunity to present to you Senate File 758, which is the Vulnerable Adult Act, it came as part of a package out of the Vulnerable Adult Justice Project. Madam Chair and members, this bill has been through the Judiciary Committee, through the Health Committee, And now it is to you, the Commerce Committee, and from here it will go to Finance. And at each of those stops, the various provisions that were within the jurisdiction of those various committees were addressed. So the sections that I have in my notes that are relevant to your committee, Madam Chair, are sections 1, 2, 5, 10, and 11. And I will speak only to those sections, and I will I have a witness here who will answer questions with respect to those sections. But with respect to your time, Madam Chair and members, I'd like to just quickly present those sections to you.
And, Senator Moore, that's exactly what we would like you to do, just those pieces.
And then there are two amendments, one of which is a technical amendment to an amendment that we put on in the Health Committee, and I know it's not within your jurisdiction, but it's just a cross-reference that was left off in that amendment. And I would ask the committee to help me make those changes.
Senator Sparks wouldn't move.
And that, Madam Chair,
would be amendment, I believe.
Yes, the A6 amendment.
This is in the packet, right?
And this is, is it already, members all have that? I think we do.
Yep.
They're in your packets, the A5 and A6. Good. So we'll do the A6. It's technical, and I see that it is totally technical. On that motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. We have the A6 amendment adopted. And then, Senator Moore, did you want to do the A5 now?
Madam Chair, it's a little bit more substantive, and I would like to do that amendment when I get to that section of the bill.
You.
I want to give you a very brief context for this bill because it's a pretty big bill, and you're only seeing one-third of the bill. I won't go on and on, but I thought it would be important for you to have a context for it. Minnesota first created a report and response system for the maltreatment of the elderly and persons with disabilities in 1980. This Vulnerable Adult Act was substantially revised in 1995. And for the past year, stakeholders from more than 20 organizations have been meeting regularly with an even greater number of staff from ombuds, persons offices, the AG's office, as well as state and county protection and regulatory agencies, to identify priorities for bringing the law in line with contemporary setting, research, and debate. As a package, so Senate File 758 is a consensus product. And as a package, its provisions are intended to combat financial exploitation, ensure the safe return of vulnerable adults who are missing and endangered, streamline and expedite the reporting system. And so the portion that is in this committee deals with the financial exploitation issue. So Section 1 of the bill, Madam Chair and members, amends the law restricting access to financial records to authorize the disclosure of financial records to law enforcement, a lead agency, or prosecuting authority that certifies in writing that it is investigating financial exploitations of a vulnerable adult. Section 2 of the bill specifies that a financial institution may notify a government entity if it has information that may be relevant to the financial exploitation of a vulnerable adult. Section 5 amends the county attorney subpoena powers to authorize the subpoena of banking and financial records of a vulnerable adult, whether held in the name of the vulnerable adult or a third party. And it is in this section of the bill that I will ask the committee to consider the A5 amendment. The A5 amendment, Madam Chair and members, did I have that right?
Actually, it's 1 and 2.
It's in 1 and 2.
It
is section 1 and 2. But the language,
it looks like you've deleting the original Section 1, or at least in the second engrossment, Section 1, and you're substituting lines 1.3 to 117. And then on Section 2, you're adding a subdivision 2.
Yes, and it actually is just rearranging the criteria that are there. The concern was raised in judiciary about administrative and judicial subpoenas and whether that would be sufficient. And while in the committee we knew that we already had that authority in the law as current language, as you see there, we felt that it wasn't quite clear to give prosecuting authority the ability to use the administrative and the judicial subpoena. So the new language, Madam Chair members, takes those two sections, pull them together to make sure that we're very clear that all those three entities, the lead agency, law enforcement, and prosecuting authority, have the ability to use the administrative and judicial subpoenas. And that's the A5 amendment.
I think Senator Marty would offer the A5 amendment. Any questions from members? On that motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails. Okay, Senator Moore.
And then the only two other provisions, Madam Chair, are really clarifications, Sections 10 and 11. Section 10 clarifies the definition of person. And Section 11 requires the financial institutions cooperate with the vulnerable adult investigations, which, again, I have an advocate here who could help me answer questions, but in the interest of time for you and your committee members, I will stand for questions.
Is it Ms. Anderson?
Yes.
Welcome to our committee. I don't know if you wanted to say anything. You're certainly welcome to do that. You have quite a long title here on our agenda.
It's because
I'm
retired.
It takes up three lines.
I'm aware of that.
And it says you're not only that, it says you're retired. This is quite a deal. So, yes, if you would like to say something.
I would. Just a few things.
Madam just Chair. Just say your name for the
My record. Name is Sandra Anderson.
Yeah, I do.
And good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the
Welcome.
Committee. And thank you for this opportunity. My title is on the page, and I don't
yes.
think we need to review
on our
that
agendas.
Anymore. I've also just completed 8 years serving on the Minnesota Board on Aging. And while on the board, I was also the representative to the Governor's Council on Developmental Disabilities and to the Vulnerable Adult Review Panel, both of which have application here. Although I'm here today as a private citizen, I'm not speaking on behalf of any of those organizations
okay.
or the bank. This is an amazing bill. This is a consensus bill. That in itself is amazing. It took a year and a half to get it together, and it involved 52 different groups. So I just want you to know the amount of work that has gone into this. Financial exploitation cases have recently been in the media, and they are still underreported and growing. As more vulnerable adults live in community settings or have limited mobility, family members and other trusted people often have very riskier, ill-defined relationships with the vulnerable adult's financial institution. In addition, crimes of financial exploitation have a time element that can work against a vulnerable adult in two ways. The first is the money can disappear very easily, very quickly. We've seen cases where there's been over $100,000 gone in 2 days. And these crimes are very, very difficult to discover. Senate File 758 takes several steps that will improve the detection of and the response to financial exploitation, beginning with a clearer definition of the crime. As this is the Commerce Committee, let me just talk about the part that involves banks and financial institutions. This bill clarifies and confirms the immunity for financial institutions so that they are encouraged, but not mandated, to report suspected maltreatment in good faith. It also ensures an institution's immunity when they cooperate with a lead agency, law enforcement, or a prosecutor by releasing requested financial records pursuant to a judicial or administrative subpoena. The bill further establishes that county attorneys will have subpoena authority for banking, credit card, and financial records of a vulnerable adult pursuant to an ongoing investigation. This can include signature cards, statements, and documentation of fraud. Allowing county attorneys to have this valuable tool will enhance their ability to intervene earlier and hopefully prevent an entire account from being completely wiped out. I thank you for the privilege of speaking to you this afternoon and for your time, and I ask your support.
Ms. Anderson, thank you very much. Senator Moore, I haven't read all the way through, but is there a way for a bank to, I mean, I'm guessing when Ms. Anderson mentions that somebody lost $100,000, or somebody went through $100,000 in 1 day or 2 days.
In that particular case, it was 2 days. But
I don't know if that raises a flag at a financial institution or not. I'm wondering, and maybe you can help answer that. And just that I want to let Senator Moore be on her way, but
it depends on exactly what the account looks like and. Okay. I mean, how much money is in the account to start with, and if there's a history, it raises a flag. But the financial institution, I mean, there's privacy laws. We can't tell anybody anything. So this is going to help.
Okay. That's what I wondered if that
yeah.
that would without fearing liability for
exactly.
raising that question. Sir,
yes.
did you want to say anything, or is that?
Madam Chair, I just came to help answer questions. So.
Okay. What is your name?
I'm Kevin Hansen with the Elder Care Rights Alliance.
Okay. Thank you. So, Senator Marty would move that Senate File 758 as amended be recommended to pass and re-referred to finance. Is
yes,
that
Madam
correct,
Chair.
Senator Moore?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Is there any further discussion from committee? Is there anybody in the audience that would like to speak in opposition to the bill? I appreciate 52 organizations. That's impressive. On that motion, on the Senator Marty motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Thank you for
and
your time.
Thank you. And we have Senator Sparks. Senate File 1849.
What?
And then we have Senator Marty.
Apparently they do with beer and brats.
Sure.
Chris.
Madam Chair, thank you for the opportunity to testify on Senate File 1849. This is the Department of Commerce Financial Institutions Technical Bill. And before we get too far into it, Madam Chair, I do have an author's amendment, the A1 amendment, that would put the bill in the shape the author would prefer.
Okay.
And while staff is handing that out, maybe I can just take a minute, too, to actually thank all of our staff, because I know as we reach this first deadline that they've been very busy preparing amendments, and we certainly appreciate all their hard work.
We do. I think Ms. Ludens was making copies up to right the moment before she came up, brought the card upstairs. So we do appreciate that. Okay. The A1 amendment, putting the bill in the shape the author would like to discuss it. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. There you go, Senator Sparks. The A1 amendment's adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And with that, I think in the interest of time, I got the long version of the explanation on Tuesday. And if the committee wants that, I'm sure the Deputy Commissioner will be willing to give that. Otherwise, I think he can give some brief remarks and explain Senate File 1849. So with that, I would introduce Deputy Commissioner Murphy and have him walk you through the bill.
Welcome, Mr. Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is our annual bill to do maintenance on the financial institution laws, and I thought I'd point out some of the high spots. A lot of this is technical wordsmithing, but the ones that are, I believe, are significant, I'll point those out.
Okay.
And talk about some of those. The very first item. Deals with reverse mortgage loans, and we have a pretty strong statute that protects seniors from abusive things. The big item is counseling, and what we're doing here is clarifying that all lenders, including mortgage brokers that might make a reverse mortgage loan, must comply with the requirements of 4758, which is the primary consumer protection statute.
Mr. Murphy, does it mesh appropriately with what's Senator Clark's bill on reverse mortgage? Do you know? Maybe it doesn't need to.
It does.
Madam Chair, it's what we're doing is make sure that people are licensed under Chapter 58 know that they have to follow the reverse mortgage loan. So it deals more with the scope of 4758. It wouldn't conflict with the reverse mortgage bill.
Okay, thank you.
See, the item two is a wording change to the payday lender law. Item three is fairly significant.
And that's section three, really?
Section three.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
That's right.
Section three will require payday lenders operating over the Internet to be licensed by the state of Minnesota, and they would be required to follow the Minnesota fee schedule, which is fairly conservative. We tried to do this by press release last summer. The industry challenged us, and we lost. So we're back here establishing a statutory foundation to do what we propose.
Okay.
Let's see. Sections 4, 5, 6, and 7 are fairly technical wordsmithing items. The next item of consequence is Section 8 and 9, which covers 16 pages in your bill. what we're doing here is we're adding a new model law recommended by the National Association of Insurance Commissioners related to audit requirements for insurance companies.
So is this the Model Act intact, Mr. Murphy?
I believe it is, Madam Chair. I've heard some feedback that we were a few places where we didn't get exactly correct. And one of the items that was pointed out to us this morning, the model law in our bill makes reference to the accounting literature, the AICPA materials. And apparently the AICPA materials were changed while the Model Act was being drafted. Some of the references don't match up perfectly, so we've agreed to meet with the accounting profession maybe later today or tomorrow and clean that up on the House side.
So, okay, that's fine, and or we can, you know, Senator Sparks can deal with that as well on the floor, but that's fine if it hasn't been heard in the House yet.
So basically what this law does is it adopts the federal Sarbanes-Oxley audit requirements for insurance companies, and it's rather voluminous, but it's a step in the right direction, and all the states are required to have this in place before 2010. We did get some feedback from St. Paul Travelers earlier today that they have some items that they have questions about, so we've also agreed to meet with those people and make whatever corrections are needed on the House side.
Okay. Thank you. Is it?
Let's see, Section 10 is a technical change. 11 is a cross-reference related to the model audit law. Section 12 is another model law recommended by the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, and that changes the commissioner's standard ordinary mortality table that's to be used on so-called pre-need insurance policies, which are small denomination, 10,000 or thereabout policies sold to people for burial expenses and the like. The 1980 table results in more conservative reserves. So the National Association in Minnesota have decided to make that change. No adverse effect to the consumer from arising from that change. Section 13 makes some changes to the Life Health Guarantee Fund law, and the guarantee fund is the safety net mechanism for consumers in the event that a life insurance company fails. Since 1992, Minnesota has had an inflation adjustment in the amount of the guarantee fund coverage, and I believe we're the only state that has that. It's a favorable thing to the consumers. What we're doing is Section 14 displays the disclosure form that is given to consumers when they buy a life insurance policy, and the form so far has not been updated to reflect all these inflationary adjustments, so we're going to annually publish the inflation adjusted changes, and the insurance companies will update the form that their agents give to customers when a policy is purchased.
Madam Chair, just a process question. I have a question about, or something I wanted to comment on, that Section 14. Do you want us to wait till we're all the way through the bill?
Well, if we're on Section 14, there, so that's fine.
Okay. Madam Chair and Assistant Commissioner, as I'm looking at the language, this is on page 31, talking about the $300,000 limit. From the summary of the bill and from your explanation, I'm gathering that what the department wants to do is be able to increase the limit above $300,000 at its discretion. I thought that's what the summary says, or the way I was reading it, but the way the language is written, it seems like it would be doing the opposite. The way the language is written, it doesn't say whether that $300,000 limit could be adjusted up or down. But then if you begin reading on 31, so in other words, you could do it either way. But then on line 31.26, where it says, subject to the limit determined by the Commissioner of Commerce, the Guarantee Association will pay up to $300,000 in life insurance benefits. To me, the way that's written means that the most they could pay is $300,000, and they could pay less than $300,000. And if...
Yeah, no, Senator Olson, it's a good question. Deputy Commissioner Murphy, do you have... Can you help us with that?
I'm looking at, Madam Chair, Senator... Looking at line 31.18 through 20, it talks about annually the Commissioner of Commerce will publish the current limits that are applicable. And I guess keep in mind that if an insurance company failed and a person had a policy that only had 100,000 coverage, certainly we wouldn't provide guarantee fund protection of 300,000. But the and we do. Each year, we do publish the updated amounts in a bulletin to the industry. I think what we're doing here is adjusting the statute to accommodate the inflation language.
And, you know, and Mr. Murphy and Senator Olson, Mr. Stang is pointing out to me on the A1 amendment, I think we have struck or we've stricken the those limitation amounts. It looks like that on page three.
Madam Chair, that's correct.
So we are raising the limits. It'll be just determined by the department, as it say, annually. Yeah. So in any case, there, I assume we've had this limit. There'd still be some limits. I mean, if somebody had a $1 million policy, you may not be guaranteeing the full face value of that, I'm assuming, but you'll some portion of that, Mr.
Madam
Murphy?
Chair, that's correct.
Yeah. So, and this is, so those.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, on line 3127, where it has 300,000 and then 3128, it says 100,000. In the amendment, we've deleted those, so those. Are blanks.
And you've got inserted blank amounts. Is that the way we want to go? Is that what we want to do here, I think? Or did you want to have a dollar amount in there?
Well, Madam Chair, I don't believe we want to have a dollar amount in the statute because it would be subject
right.
to the inflationary adjustment. So we would have a blank in there, and then we would publish annually the list of the coverages. The companies would take that information and it adopted into the form that they would redo every year.
Senator Olson.
Given to the consumer.
Well, Madam Chair, if that's what they want to do, then the A1 amendment isn't going to provide the right language for them to do that, because that looks like it's been designed to insert whatever amount is determined through this legislative process to be inserted there. But I would still say that the way that this is written on line 31.26, subject to the limit determined by the Commissioner of Commerce, the Guarantee Association will pay up to.
And if it's then not, this is a form.
Right.
So what we are looking at is a form, and they would fill in that number that would be given, that they would determine annually, and this is what the consumer would see. So it would have a number in there when the consumer receives this notice, I assume, Mr.
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Does that make sense?
Okay, Madam Chair, that I guess that maybe helps make a little bit more sense in my mind, because the way I was reading it is that this was reflecting the language of the law, in which case the way it's written, the most they could ever pay would be $300,000, and I think that doesn't sound like that's the intent.
Right, right. I think it probably would grow. That's the expectation. Am I correct, Mr. Murphy?
Madam Chair, it has indeed grown over the years.
Madam Chair?
I was going to ask, what is it today?
I believe...
It's $300,000 today.
Well, Madam Chair, I know that the $100,000 is now up to $130,000, I believe.
Okay.
I remember that one.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, Assistant Commissioner, do you think that there should be something to say, but that in no event shall the amount guaranteed? Obviously, you're not going to pay more than what the insurance policy limit was for, but that we're not going to be able to go backwards, so that we're always going to make sure we're insuring or guaranteeing at least $300,000? Because I'm not sure that there's anything in here that wouldn't give the way that this change is being made, that wouldn't give the commissioner the authority to do that, or am I wrong about that?
Give the commissioner the authority to do what, Senator Olson? I'm sorry.
To guarantee in a lower amount, even though I know that's not the intent. But are we changing, or is it just this form and there's another reference maybe in statute somewhere else that says that they have to guarantee at least $300,000?
I don't know the answer to that. I don't know if I don't think so. I mean, I think that they arguably they'd be free to raise this or lower it. I think that's not what's happening, but Mr. Murphy?
Madam Chair, maybe if we look at Section 13, line 29, Section 13, line 29, 31.
With amounts adjusted for inflation. Okay.
So, unfortunately, we don't have the entire statute in front of us here, just the parts that are being changed. But
it looks like the intent is to adjust for inflation. I think I understand. Is that sufficient, Senator Olson?
Madam Chair, yes, and I'm sorry to spend a lot of time on this. I just wanted to
Senator Olson.
Make sure that we weren't set without realizing it, perhaps allowing for a lesser security on these insurance policies. I don't think that was anyone's intent.
And the form itself is pretty clear, I think, that people realize that there are limitations on what will be guaranteed. So, and Mr. Murphy, you said that Minnesota is the only state that not that has a guarantee association, but what did you say about?
Madam Chair, all the states have a guarantee fund mechanism or a safety net mechanism, but Minnesota, I believe, is the only state that has this inflation adjustment in the dollar limits.
I think we get it now. So go carry on. I think we're on page 32.
See, sections 15 through 21.
Page 32 to 36.
Well, I'm just waiting until you get to the one I'm really waiting for. Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, I can hardly wait.
Oh, Mr. Murphy, so those sections are
Sections 15 through 21 relate to township mutual insurance companies, and these are small companies operating in rural Minnesota that provide fire insurance coverage. They're owned by the policyholders, and our people at the Commerce Department, specifically Assistant Commissioner Jackie Gardner, sat down with the township mutual industry and basically rewrote the township mutual law to make it easier to navigate for both the department and the township mutuals. We've clarified the net worth and solvency requirements and the territories that they can operate in.
But and I understand from Mr. Marsh, from Marcus Marsh, that is what did occur, that you worked with them. So we appreciate knowing that. Okay, Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My specific concern relates to Section 16.
Section
16. Which is on page 34, beginning at line 34.33.
Yes.
And this is the language that eliminates a director's. It allows the corporation to vote to eliminate a director's personal liability to the company or its members for monetary damages for breach of fiduciary duty as a director. And then it does have some exceptions for things like intentional misconduct and so forth. But I guess I just think, especially in today's environment where we have had people working in banking, people working in, you know, there where the oversight over other people's money has been handled in a way that I think is not responsible of fiduciary duties. This is a big issue at both the state and national level. And obviously anybody who's doing business is in a better position from their perspective if their liability is limited. But it just doesn't seem to be the right direction to go. I don't support this, and I'm just wondering what the rationale would be for giving that kind of freedom from answering to shareholders for a breach of fiduciary duty.
Now, when it goes on to say they may not eliminate it, and it looks like those are fiduciary responsibilities.
Well, Madam Chair, yes. For these certain exceptions,
right.
They can't.
Right.
But the general rule is going to be that they can eliminate responsibility for fiduciary duty, but not for these certain things.
Right.
So I'm assuming that, you know, it's setting a much higher standard for a stakeholder to be able to pursue any kind of recourse if there's been a breach of fiduciary duty.
Mr. Murphy, did you want to speak to that, or perhaps Mr. Marsh?
Madam Chair, I think I could talk about that a little bit.
And
that's an excellent point, Senator. And when I read through this bill, that question popped into my head also, especially in these times where there are a lot of bad things going on in the financial world. But actually what we're doing here is in remodeling the township mutual laws, we deleted several sections and replaced them with the new language. And basically, we're taking existing language and putting it back into the statute in a different place. So this really is existing law. We're just moving it around.
So we might find it back here in the...
I think it would show up in the part that's repealed, and I don't know if that shows up in your bill, but...
I see it.
I believe it was in 67A17.
Subdivision 3.
Page 7R, okay. It's in the last page of the repealers in 67A, set point 17 under assessments. Okay. So it looks like we're... You see that, Senator Olson? It's apparently... I assume that doesn't...
Madam Chair and Assistant
take care
Commissioner,
of your concern.
I appreciate that, you know, the explanation that that's what caused it to be put in here. I still think, especially in light of our financial situation that we're facing today and perhaps what we've learned about the lack of regulation and oversight and lowering of standards for those who are investing and in overseeing other people's money, that adopting or even if it's readopting language that allows that to happen is not really justifiable from my perspective. So, Madam Chair, I would like to move to delete Section 16 from the bill.
So, maybe Mr. Marsh wants to...
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Olson, you understand Senator Olson's motion here. I was just trying to think of what the impact of it was, so feel free to comment here.
Yeah, Madam Chair and committee members, it's my understanding, as Deputy Commissioner Murphy referred to, this was brought forth by our legal counsel because there's other you have to reference other sections of statute where it's the liability issues come into play. So this is just actually trying to be a correction of statutes. I wish I had that reference with me, but I don't. But this was considered not reducing or eliminating anything that isn't already in statute for protection. It's a recodification because of other references in statute. Because a lot of our laws are referenced also under 72A and
So I have been assured as we were working on this that this was not reducing the liability of our directors, of our member companies.
Senator Olson?
Madam Chair, well, and I think what we just heard is probably the same thing that the Assistant Commissioner just said, which is, you know, this language was somewhere else, and now that you're changing it around, you're basically just inserting the same language back in. But just to make it clear, it wouldn't be the case that there's some other language other some other place that would contradict this, because this is specific language that gives you an exemption from liability that other situations wouldn't enjoy. And so the specific is going to take precedence over something more general. So if we give them this limitation in terms of liability for breach of fiduciary duties, this will be the law. And I'm not arguing with you that it might already be the law, but we would be continuing that practice. And so my concern is that that may not be a good idea anymore, and especially when we've seen what's happened with lack of higher standards for fiduciary duties and responsibility for handling people's money. So that's, Madam Chair, I'm not contradicting the witness. I'm just
right.
Trying
no,
to put
Senator Olson, I find it hard to understand why the language would be in there in any case to limit the liability for fiduciary duty, because the items that are mentioned are definitely part of fiduciary duties. I don't know what else there would be. And I assume there are other fiduciary duties. I just don't know off the top of my head what some of them might be. But, you're free to offer the amendment. And Mr. Marsh and Mr. Murphy, Senator Sparks, are probably going to talk about this some more, I assume.
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, I guess the best I can tell you for today is that we feel that the director language, there's other director language that protects the public, and what again we're trying to do is there's other references, and I wish I had that with you. I can check with our legal counsel, and I guess I feeling as we negotiated with the department. The department looked at all of this because the issue is of this legislation. Our meetings were prompted by the department in rewriting our statutes, and so there's no intent to do anything less for protection of the public. I mean, we're the closest of any the insurance industry to the public with our small companies and communities. That's the last thing we want to do is not protect the public. So, again, this was brought by our legal counsel, and I would like to keep the bill intact, but what I would certainly do is provide to the committee as quick as possible the references and what the statute says as it relates to protection of our the indemnity of our directors.
Now there are, I don't know what 302A exceptions would be, but Senator Olson, might you consider striking the new language on line 33 and 34 up to the period, and then leaving the other language, and then they can work perhaps on something that, that doesn't even really make a whole lot of sense in and of itself. I'm sure it goes with something else, but.
Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
It does make sense to me from a legal standpoint, and I'll see if I can try to explain it. This is not, I know a little bit about this, but not enough to be more than just dangerous probably, but I understand that the witness is, it's hard to have a discussion about a legal issue when you're legal counsel's advised you something and you're, you know, not a lawyer. But I do think that while the intent, no one's ever intending to be, you know, not responsible to the public, there is common law on this subject that would make a corporation responsible for their fiduciary duties. And there's a whole body of law that would generally apply and hold financial institutions responsible for their fiduciary duties to their shareholders. Now, this, when you have a specific law that gives an exception, then that will be the law we will have passed, and there isn't going to be a contradictory law that's going to give the shareholders those protections, because this is very specific and it's providing an exemption. And it looks
for a director, not for the company.
For a director, or yes, for a director. And what it seems to me that this is putting in place is saying they're not going to be responsible for things that would be more in the range or the realm of negligence, as opposed to the higher standard that these exceptions represent. So in other words, the intentional misconduct types of things they'll be responsible for. But if it's something that would be probably the majority of things that they could be held accountable for, violations of fiduciary duties for things they reasonably should have known and didn't do but weren't intentional, they will be exempt for those kinds of things. And so if you think about it kind of in the civil context, it's kind of like general negligence versus gross negligence type of thing. And we're saying they're only going to be held accountable for breaches of fiduciary duty that are more like the gross negligence kinds of things. That's how I'm reading this.
Okay. And I think Senator Olson raises a valid concern about what that would mean. I don't know if it exists in other corporate law or not. I don't know about directors' exemption from personal liability. I don't know how often we hold a member of a board of director personally liable, other than those kinds of intentional kinds of things. Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, I don't know if it's when they're not personally liable, if it's not intentional, but I know I've served on some boards where they provide liability insurance for the directors just because of this, and I would assume that means there is a risk that any of the directors would have. It seems to me that would be the way they would deal with their directors here. But well, you're suggesting, Madam Chair, that she could delete everything up to the period on line 34 and line 33. I mean, that wouldn't change what Senator Olson's trying to do. I don't know if that's what you had said, but
you wouldn't have the exemption. You would,
right.
You wouldn't line 33 and 34 have the exemption. I'm fine. I mean, I certainly will entertain, and I actually support the amendment, Senator Olson. I think there may be, you know, they'll have further conversation, and Mr. Marsh will talk to legal counsel and find out how this corresponds to other kinds of corporate law. Yes, Senator Olson.
Well, and Madam Chair, I'm not sure if this is going anywhere after this or just going to the floor, but if my motion does pass, I'll be happy to work with Senator Sparks to see if we can find some that standard and make sure that we're not unfairly treating, you know, this particular type of a corporation as opposed to others.
Madam Chair, just to
yes,
make
Mr.
sure.
Marsh.
We do obviously indemnify anybody that serves on any of the boards of our companies. There is, you know, major insurance policies in place to indemnify directors. Obviously, they wouldn't be willing to serve unless there was.
Okay. On the Olson amendment,
sure.
Yes, Senator Gerlach.
I'm just wondering if Senator Sparks would, maybe I missed it, but if he could comment on whether or not he's in favor or in opposition to the amendment.
Senator Sparks.
Sure. Madam Chair and Senator Gerlach, I wasn't a part of the negotiation process, and I think in the interest of time, I think that I will allow the committee to decide what they want to do moving forward, but if the amendment does pass, we'll continue to work with Senator Olson. I'm sure that Mr. Marsh will do that and try to find some language that makes everyone a little bit more comfortable.
Okay. Okay. On the Senator Olson's motion to strike Section 17 from the bill.
16.
What did I say?
17.
I looked right at it and said 17. I'm sorry. Section 16. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails. And I know that we'll keep working. And Senator Sparks and Mr. Marsh and the department will keep going. Okay. And then that brought us to...
Madam Chair, it brings us to section...
Mr. Marsh, thank you.
Section 22, which is transition rules related to Section 12 of the bill. 23 is the repealer. First item, we repeal the old insurance audit law. Second one is we're repealing parts of the old township mutual law. Item three, we're eliminating an obsolete, obscure banking rule. And item four, we're eliminating rules related to debt prorating companies. We no longer have debt prorating companies. We now have debt management companies. So we should probably talk a little bit about the amendment, Madam Chair. The
A1 amendment?
The A1 amendment, Madam Chair. The last summer, there were some federal laws changed that affect the mortgage industry across the country, including the level of education requirements required in Chapter 58. So,
okay.
So we're changing the pre-licensing education from 15 hours to 20 to comply with the new federal requirements. So we're adding a continuing education requirement of 8 hours per year. That would be effective after September of 2009. Also, one of the provisions in the federal law is to impose a testing requirement for natural persons acting as mortgage originators. So we're authorizing us in last item C to, we're authorizing ourselves to do rulemaking with respect to establishing a testing requirement. The rest of the amendment basically moves things around in our bill.
I had a question to ask Mr. Murphy about the audits and the fact, I mean, generally the regulation of insurance is left to the states. And can you tell me, and I have a resolution I'm going to be offering to the committee here shortly having to do, you know, opposing the optional federal charter that's been discussed in Congress in recent years. Is this just a recodification, or is this a... I think not. I think it's a response to federal regulation. Is that something that we've lived with before, this kind of regulation of
the,
insurance?
Madam Chair, the Sarbanes-Oxley Amendment added some pretty heavy-duty audit requirements to publicly traded companies in response to Enron and things like that. Much of the insurance industry is not subject to the same laws, partly because the companies are not publicly traded. Many are mutuals, but we're trying to raise the audit standards of the insurance industry through this model law, which has been vetted heavily at the National Association of Insurance Commissioner level. But the the state insurance regulators and the industry reached a consensus, and after 3 years of discussion, and this model act was the outcome of that. But, Madam Chair, it's not a federal mandate. It's just a meeting of the minds by the insurance regulators across the country and the industry that this is the way to go to upgrade the requirements. There are some requirements for waivers for smaller companies and hardships and whatnot.
Okay. Then I know Ms. Turner wished to speak, and since we're talking about the audit piece, I think that may be one of her concerns. Ms. Turner, welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Bev Turner with Travelers. Uh, A few of the provisions that I'd like to address are in Section 9, and I had an opportunity to talk to Deputy Commissioner Murphy this morning, as well as Senator Sparks, and welcome the opportunity to further discuss and hopefully address those concerns that we have. And I know it was stated that these particular audit provisions in Section 9 are part of the model audit rule or parallel them, and my financial folks did note that there are some inconsistencies with the model audit rule that they drew to my attention and found to be problematic, that we should correct those. And hopefully these are unintended consequences of wordsmithing that occurred between the revisor's office and staff that we can hopefully correct as this bill goes forward. Particularly, though, I'd just like to point out some of the subdivisions just to let you know. One would be the availability and maintenance of the independent CPA's papers that requires the insurance company to actually require the CPA to make their work papers available and accessible to the department. When we have no control over those independent CPA work papers, we can't control them because they're not our papers. Another provision deals with the requirements for the audit committee, and that provision particularly does not track with the model audit rule, and that's problematic for us because there could be some potential conflicts with business corporate law in those provisions. Another is the internal control reporting requirement, as well as the commercial mortgage loan valuation, and then the examination of authorization that we found to have problems and inconsistencies with the model rule. So we are certainly welcome the opportunity to work with the department and Senator Sparks on addressing those issues so that we do have a system that is parallel with the model audit rule.
Okay. Thank you. Is there anybody else who wanted to speak to the bill? I think you still are working with the CPA organization about some language there.
Madam Chair, that is true. I know that they were in to see you this morning, and we had a discussion with the Minnesota Society of Certified Public Accountants. And again, I think that with some work, we can easily come to a resolution in that regard. Okay. And we'll continue to address Ms. Turner's issues as well.
And Senator Metzen, this
bill. Well, I was just thinking, how long has this bill been around? I mean, we're going to fix it up.
Hours.
But, oh, is that all? Sorry. Okay, I'm just going
to. No, I was wondering why. I knew what you were going to say.
Why Ms. Turner comes here at the 11th hour, and why Mr. Sparks, who's a great author, a great senator, didn't fix this up earlier, but it's a late on arrival. Is that correct? I figured there had to be a good reason.
Yeah.
This wasn't all pre-worked out.
That happened with several of our bills.
Unfortunately, that's the way it goes.
Senator Sparks, therefore, would like to move.
Madam Chair, I do have one more. I know we're kind of pressed for time,
okay.
But I would like to offer the A2 amendment as well.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's fine.
Yes. I knew this too. You want to speak to it?
Yes,
the A2 amendment.
Madam Chair, this was brought forth by a community state chartered bank, and what it does is extends the holding period for other real estate. And what it basically will do will move that time period from 5 to 10 years, that will provide more flexibility to the lender.
Where is the 5-year requirement? That's what when I saw this amendment, I wondered what that was. It said. Or maybe it's in the bill someplace. Maybe it's there. Senator Olson?
Madam Chair, you know, I'm sure I'd be really interested in hearing both sides of this issue, because I guess what I'm wondering about is with all the foreclosures and so forth, I'm sure the banks would like more flexibility and be able to perhaps hang on to an asset so that the market might come back up or something, you know, so that they don't have to take a loss. On the other hand, it seems like we really want to get these houses back on the market, and that this might be an incentive not to cooperate with the mediation and other kinds of things that we've put in place to try to encourage lenders to make sure that, you know, mortgages are renegotiated and so forth. And so it seems like there could that this could be a fairly big policy concern or issue that we really should hear from both sides about. That's kind of what I'm thinking.
Actually, Senator Olson, there may be more. I mean, cities may have an interest as well as consumers or homeowners. Or
Madam Chair, right, because, you know, this might mean that property would sit vacant longer or something, too.
Mr. Johnson, yes.
Madam Chair, Steve Johnson, representing the Minnesota Bankers Association. We represent about 95% of the banks in Minnesota, large and small community banks across your area. Specifically to the question Senator Olson raised, the five-year limitation is actually a rule. It's in Rule 2675-2170, so 2675.2170, Item C. So just as reasonable attempts shall be made to dispose of the real estate by sale, other real estate files shall be documented with disposal attempts. The maximum period for holding other real estate as an asset shall be 5 years. So that's by rule. And as Senator Sparks mentioned, this was brought forth by a community banker saying that if we are mandated by law with a specific time frame, we may actually have to sell this property before the marketplace has actually risen, which actually not only impacts the bank, but frankly could impact the other properties in that area. I mean, if that property sold at a lower value, then maybe that would lower the property values of other properties and also could affect the tax collection of those properties. So, and then kind of one other point I'd like to make, and I talked to that banker again today about what kind of property we're typically talking about here, and what we're typically talking about are mostly like lots and development land and possibly commercial. It's not really about vacant and abandoned houses from this banker's perspective.
Senator Olson.
Well, Madam Chair, I can see why bankers would not want to have to hold, you know, things that would deteriorate in value if they sit empty. So I understand that comment. But it just seems to me like this is an awfully big issue to not have given notice of, you know, because it involves all those other interests in terms of it being a bill. I guess I just think it should be a bill so that I don't feel comfortable supporting it without feeling like we've really explored this and heard from everyone who might have an interest in it.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Olson, the other thing I failed to point out as nationally chartered banks, the OCC, Office of Comptroller Currency, that oversees them actually provides more flexibility for the national banks. So in essence, you got a little bit of an unlevel playing field with the national charter and the state charter. Thus, that's one of the reasons that we thought this would be a time to bring that forward. So just one other point I wanted to throw in.
Mr. Johnson, do you know what that is?
They talk about a five-year term, but if there's a reasonable attempt to sell the property or my notes here, or if the disposal within 5 year period would be detrimental to that entity, then the OCC allows them up to another 5 years to do it. So
maybe we should look at language like that. I don't know, but that's up to the committee to decide. Any other questions from committee members? Mr. Johnson, did you want to see? Senator Sparks? I know you had worked with Mr. Johnson, and the department felt that was reasonable? Or?
Madam Chair, the department has no objection to the amendment.
Okay.
Is there anyone from the cities here?
I don't know. Is there anyone? That's a good question. Is there anyone here from the cities, League of Cities, or representing a community? I don't see anybody.
You have to hit my hat. No.
Senator Sparks has offered the A2 amendment. I guess without further discussion, those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
I think it does not prevail. So.
Division.
Madam Chair. Division on that? Okay. Those in favor say aye. Or raise your hand, I should say. Okay. And those opposed? Those opposed are really noisy people.
We're noisy.
We speak up.
So the motion prevails. I stand corrected, or sit corrected, and the A2 amendment is adopted. With that, we have Senate File 1849 as amended. Senator Sparks moved that it be recommended to pass, and I guess it goes to the floor. There's nothing, no penalties or anything. Any further discussion? Anybody else wish to testify on this?
Just like you're becoming.
All those in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails. Senator Sparks.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you. Senator Marty.
Hard.
Madam Chair, Senator Marty. 1469 is a bill that would prohibit a health plan from refusing to give coverage to a woman because of a previous cesarean section. And I didn't know this was occurring, but we had testimony in the Health Committee about this occurring now, and given that a fourth of all the births are C-section, it's 19,000 some a year, and just saying we're not going to underwrite insurance for a woman because of that, we're really getting to the point where being female is a pre-existing condition. And I don't think we want to go that way. And this bill would just put what five states have already done, and that is that you would prohibit health carriers from offering, selling, issuing a plan, and we have an amendment to it solely on the basis that the individual had a previous C-section. And because of the fact that that the obvious thing you could do if you can't prohibit somebody from getting coverage because of it, then the next thing one might do is jack up the rate significantly. We have an A1 amendment to address that.
Did you want to offer
that? I would like to offer that. And while we're waiting, I have a couple witnesses to testify on this. And
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you. My name is Heather Dietrich. I'm a member of the International Cesarean Awareness Network of the Twin Cities and the Minnesota Better Birth Coalition. A little background. This first gained public attention last summer. The New York Times had an article regarding this, and also the Star Tribune in just January brought this up. What's happening is insurance companies are refusing to cover women with prior cesarean surgery unless they meet certain criteria, such as having been surgically sterilized or being over the age of 40. And this trend's been reported in Colorado, Florida, Michigan, and here in Minnesota last week. Rebecca Polston testified it had happened to her. She had a previous cesarean. She also had a previous vaginal delivery but was still denied insurance. The full scope, however, is really not known. According to January 2009 report, there are over 243,000 Minnesotans have individual health plans, which is what this is affecting, and 19,500 cesarean surgeries in Minnesota. It's over one-fourth of all births, and we know this rate is rising. If insurance companies deny coverage or charge higher premiums to all those women, it amounts to a windfall profit at the expense of young families. We feel this is unjust and wrong. There are currently five states that have laws against this practice. That's New York, New Jersey, Washington, Vermont, and Massachusetts. We feel the need for this bill arises in part from insurers' knowledge that women who have had a cesarean have a high rate of repeat cesareans, and that they have a much higher rate of morbidity with subsequent pregnancies. And the solution is not to deny women insurance, but rather to decrease the rate of cesareans to the about 15% guidelines, and also to increase the rate of vaginal births after cesarean VBACs. Thank you.
Thank you. Did you wish to testify?
Just, yes.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Sarah Shannon. I'm also a representative of the International Caesarean Awareness Network of the Twin Cities. In the interest of time, Heather said most of the important points. I'll just emphasize the last few points that as a woman who's had both a cesarean and then a vaginal birth after cesarean, I really do think that rather than denying women coverage, the best interest of the insurance companies would be to try to find ways to promote doctors and hospitals supporting vaginal birth after cesarean and normal birth rather than surgical birth. It's very difficult after having had a cesarean to find doctors and hospitals to support that, and so that really would be in the interest of all women's health as well as cutting costs in this area. Thank you.
Okay.
So, Madam Chair, the amendment is simply because obviously if we prohibited somebody from refusing to underwrite because of a C-section, then they could simply accomplish the same thing by charging a higher premium. So this amendment would include that in the prohibition of the bill. So I'll move that amendment.
I don't know.
I think maybe I ask Ms. Coleman to testify first, if that's all right.
That's fine.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Danette Coleman. I'm Vice President of Public Policy and Government Affairs for Medica, and today I'm here representing the 8 nonprofit health plans through the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. We did not have an opportunity to see the amendment before it was offered, so I can't provide specific information as to the impact of that. But I do want to make a couple comments. As the bill was originally drafted, the 8 health plans and the Council of Health Plans would not be impacted by it and having to change our behavior. We do not currently deny somebody coverage solely for the fact that they have had a C-section. There was testimony in Senator Marty's committee of an individual who actually was with Medica who had testified that it was a primary reason, but there were other reasons as well as to why she had been denied coverage. It wasn't solely because she had had a C-section. So one of the things that I would like to point out here is that We do have a concern, even as originally drafted, it wasn't a practice that we were using. We have a concern with this piecemeal approach to regulating the individual insurance market. The individual insurance market in Minnesota is priced based on what we expect the risk to be. And so if you are going to be passing legislation here that says you can't increase a premium or underwrite a person for this condition or this condition or this condition, we will absolutely comply with the law as we do with any other law that you pass here. But it will impact premiums, and it will drive up the cost of the individual market and will price more people out of the market. So the Council of Health Plans in previous years has come forward with some ideas on how to fix the entire individual market and not just piecemeal regulate it. So, for example, the Council of Health Plans has said, and actually recently, in the last couple of weeks, our national association, the American Health Insurance Plans, have also come forward and said that insurers need to look at ways to provide coverage and to not deny people for existing medical conditions or pre-existing conditions, which is referred to as guarantee issue. Anybody who applies can get coverage. We've stepped forward and said we will accept guarantee issue, but in order to do that, to keep the premiums affordable for all, we also need an enforceable individual mandate that ensures that the young, healthy people go into the risk pool so that we can spread the risk across a large group of people and make it affordable for all. So, again, I'll leave my comments there and be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Members have any questions? Senator Olson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just going to point out that what the witness has just described is our components of Senator Marty's Minnesota health plan, which we passed in this committee, guaranteed issue, and everyone pays, you know, but there are other components in the Minnesota health plan that go beyond that to make it more fair. For example, premiums are based on what someone can afford to pay, and it kind of puts a whole system in place. Unfortunately, we're not there yet, you know, and we don't have the Minnesota health plan in place. There are some other components in Senator Marty's plan that would help reduce costs by eliminating administrative management types of fees that that aren't being offered by the health plans. So in the meantime, it seems to me like while we taking the piecemeal approach may not be the ideal solution, that this is justified because what happens to women in these kinds of situations is they either are going to have to pay a lot more by going into MSHA, which is not really affordable for most people, and they may actually have a more difficult time because well, I guess I won't even say that because this only applies to individual plans, but it does seem to have a by far undue impact only on one gender in a way that doesn't seem fair.
Senator Vandiver.
Senator Olson, did you say someone's going to lose their job? Management?
I'm Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, Senator Vandiver. Madam Chair, Senator Vandiver, under this proposal that Senator Marty is bringing forth, we're just talking, we're not talking about the Minnesota Health Plan. Under the Minnesota Health Plan, I'm not sure that we want to go all the way there.
I'm sure we don't.
Yeah. Okay.
But you said there's going to be less.
Madam Chair, Senator I never Olson. Mentioned the word job. I'd be happy to have that conversation offline with Senator Vandiver.
I was just looking
Senator
for the
Vandiver.
I was just looking for the common thread, but if we don't have one, then that's a good day.
So, is there anybody else who wishes to testify before we vote on the amendment? All those in favor of the Marty A1 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails. And Senator Marty has Senate File 1469. So, as amended. So Senator Marty moves that Senate File 1469 as amended be recommended to pass, and it came to us from Health, Housing, and Family Security, so it would go to the floor. Anybody else wish to speak to the bill? Discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails. Senator Marty.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I saw Senator Sparks' technical bill take an hour and a quarter, and I'm glad to not take a long time on one bill.
And now, the chair has bill. So,
does this have anything to do with ticks?
Sparky.
Senator Marty? Does this have anything to do with ticks?
Yeah.
I have my bills.
It's coming next year, Senator Vandiver.
He's going to put the universal tag on the healthcare bill on this one.
It's a vehicle.
It's a vehicle. Not
it's a
vehicle.
This is the
vehicle.
Hey.
Yeah. Your phone.
That was under the tent.
Was this a past bill?
Tick, not tax.
I said tax.
What ticks?
Never mind.
Boy, I can't keep up with you.
I'll talk to you about it later.
We'll sit in my
please don't.
Senator Scheid.
Oh, Mr. Chairman, what do I have next?
Senate File 1778.
I'm sorry.
Resolution urging Congress to do something.
Yes.
Please.
Mr. Chairman, yes. I've never, I don't think I've ever had a resolution before, but this comes. And members may remember some kind of conversation about this on the floor of the Senate, actually, a few years ago. We passed the Interstate Compact for life insurance, health, I think life, health, long-term care insurance. And we talked about the need for more uniformity among the states to approve certain products and whatnot. And Senator Berglund rose and spoke in favor of that based on the fact that the regulation of insurance by states is somewhat at risk just because there has been movement afoot in Washington for federal regulation of insurance. And I like to say that, you know, they did such a bang-up job with financial institutions, why would we ever turn over the regulation of insurance to the federal government? I don't know. But there are some companies, some big companies that would like to have just the federal charter, but I think it's in the state's interest that we continue to regulate insurance and not turn that over. I'm sure members get questions about insurance. I know Senator Olson does hear from people who have concerns about their insurance, and I think we all get those constituent concerns raised about insurance, and I'd hate to think that people would have to call Washington to deal with those. And in addition to all of that, I think that there's a substantial sum of money in premium taxes that go to the states right now, and whether or not that would continue is very debatable. It's very difficult to believe that if the federal government's going to regulate insurance that they would continue to let the states collect the premium tax, at least at the rate that we know now. So this and I have to tell you that because this is our last day of meeting and trying to meet deadline, I brought it forward today. But even as we speak, I think there's some legislation that's coming up in Congress that I haven't noted in here. My reference is to what was introduced in 2007 for that two-year term of Congress. I think some other kinds of regulatory measures are being introduced, mostly having to do with financial services, but it looks like it could include insurance. And I think one of the things that's confusing to people is to look at, for example, well, the big example, of course, is AIG. And that's a very large insurance company. But the part that had trouble didn't have to do with the individual insurance companies. It was the other business they got into with credit default swaps, I think, and other iffy financial dealings that got them into trouble. They're insurance companies, and I'm not sure how many there are, but I think mine says 170, but I think I read something from the department that said 70. So anyway, they have a substantial number of individual insurance companies doing business under different names, and those being regulated by the states are in good financial shape and not the threat, to the company and the country that the larger corporation inflicted on itself and on us. So I don't, if you want to read through this, I don't really want to read through the whole thing. And Senator Metzen maybe would read it for us, but
we've already read it.
The gist of what I want. And I think that the commissioner wanted to say something as well. I'd like him to.
Commissioner Wilson, thank you, or welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members, and Senator Scheid. It certainly has been a primary issue before me the entire time that I've been in this position, and I appreciate the opportunity to respond to this resolution today. Clearly, in light of the fact of some of the things that are going on at the federal level in terms of regulation of financial institutions, there's no justifiable reason in my mind that we should fall into line and allow the states not to regulate the insurance industry. One of the things that clearly in our department, it's the entire focus of the department. Practically everything we do and the actions we take are directed toward the protection of the consumer. As an example, very quickly, we have 20,000 phone calls a year where we try and help the consumer understand the policy, and in turn, a lot of those 3,800 result in an investigation, and between $1.8 million and $2 million a year is passed back from the insurance companies in the form of recovery. The senator already mentioned the case of AIG, and it is a perfectly good example. But this past week, another case came up in the media here locally where Travelers was identified as somebody that might be able to step forward and buy some of the toxic assets that came out of the mess on the financial side. And the reason is that the insurance companies have money. They have reserves. Secondly, they're well run by and large, and they know how to identify underwrite and buy good assets. So that is a result oftentimes at the way we regulate the insurance companies. We regulate them for the long term. I like to tell people that part of my job is to look at the marketplace. When I buy a life insurance policy and a lot of other long-term policy, 45 years ago, 46 years ago, a couple 30 years ago, and I'm still hoping to last another 20 years. That's a 70-year span where it's the responsibility of our department to see that the solvency of these companies are there to pay the debt, the obligations that they've committed to. So, again, I wanted to bring that up because it's sometimes forgotten. The other thing is, and Senator Scheid is exactly right, with the cooperation of the Minnesota legislature and this committee particularly, we have addressed some of the issues, many of the issues that the large companies have brought forward as impediments to their doing business efficiently. As an example, the compact is a perfect one, but we have many, many, including the uniform licensing across the country. Another one, we have electronic mandated filings of forms now, which makes it significantly quicker. And I could go on, but we have addressed those, and I thank this committee for helping us in those areas. Another area that I think that needs to be mentioned, and that's the state revenues. There's no question in my mind, and again, the senator mentioned the premium tax. That's $346 million last year in premium tax alone. But there are other areas that we address, and licensing is $7,300,000. The fines to agents is $1,400,000. Fines to the agency, $700,000. Fines to the corporations was a little bit down this year. Bob's up and down, but $800,000 most recently. So there are a lot of dollars tied to this for the state, and I agree with Senator Scheid's conclusion that given the movement of this to the federal level, it wouldn't be long until a good deal of that, if not all of that, income was transferred. The last item that I wanted to note is that we really appreciate the cooperation that we've had, and I want to state here clearly and fully, we at the department support this resolution and think that the state is best served by the state having the ability to regulate on behalf of the consumers here in Minnesota. And thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Commissioner. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Scheid and Commissioner Wilson. You know, I have to say that I have somewhat mixed feelings about this because, and I'll say it as respectfully but as directly as I can, we have many issues that come in front of this committee where there are insurance company issues, and there are, at least from my perspective, consumer issues or consumer concerns, and they're not always in accord with each other. For example, I'll just use this as the most recent example, the credit scoring bill that I had here just in the last few days. And nationally, there are consumer groups that are voicing strong concerns about this practice. And there are other departments of commerce that have even conducted studies into this. And the federal and Congress is looking into this and expressing concerns. And we don't seem to have anyone expressing concerns from an organizational standpoint on behalf of consumers in Minnesota. And I'll just use that as one example because I think I could kind of go through a long list of those kinds of examples where I have concerns. On the other hand, I think it's fair to say that, for example, with ERISA, that the federal government has done a very poor job of having any consumer protection for those kinds of self-insured plans where they preempted the area. And where, you know, where we at least have a Fair Claims Practices Act, we can enforce against things that are still subject to our state law. So that's why I'm trying to kind of look at this in a balanced way and say, to me, it just totally depends on who's doing a better job of protecting the consumer across the board on these issues. And, of course, as a state senator, I hate to see anything go outside of our, you know, area of jurisdiction. But I am concerned when an industry has a lot of money and a lot of power and can come in, sometimes flying in from around the country, and make represent their interests. And it seems like the consumer interest, in some cases at least, gets stronger support at the national level. So I will support Senator Scheid's bill, but I just wanted to say that because I do have, I think it just depends on who's doing the better job and that there's some points to be made in both directions there.
Senator Scheid.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move the resolution. I understand where Senator Olson is coming from. I understand her comments, and I think from time to time we agree, from time to time we disagree about what's the better direction, but I think that we none of us would make an argument that the federal government did a very good job in terms of regulating banking and mortgage lending to the interests of the consumer. And so, I mean, I think they just totally abandoned their responsibility. The SEC, for example, and others, I mean, it looks like there just was no attention being paid to what was truly happening. So having said that, I just think it's much better that we know that the companies here are sound, and we have great confidence that they are, and because they are regulated closely by the state. And so while we may not agree on all of the consumer protections, I think that we at least want people to know that when they're paying on an insurance policy, they're going to be able, mm-hmm. you know, to receive the benefit of that. And we may agree or disagree on what that level of benefit is and what's the bargain, you know, what you bargained for, but from time to time. But I think that we should be proud of the status of insurance companies in this state in terms of how well run and how well regulated they are. So, Mr. Chairman, I would move that Senate File 1778 be recommended to pass. I think it goes to rules, does it? Not sure.
Resolution. I believe it does.
Mr. Stang?
Madam Chair, I'm not sure about that.
I think it does.
Yes. So that would be my motion.
Oh, Mr. Knapp, would you like
to? Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, I'm sorry. I did allude to the fact that there are some companies that
welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Scheid, members of the committee. I'll be very brief. My name is John Knapp. I'm representing the American Insurance Association. The AIA represents approximately 350 major insurance companies that provide all lines of property and casualty insurance and write more than $123 billion annually in premiums. The AIA endorses the optional federal charter that embodies AIA principles for regulatory reform and ensures that regulation of property casualty insurance rates and forms is market-driven and that overall insurance regulation in other areas is consistent and uniform. As we have been discussing, the landscape of financial services marketplace has become more integrated, more market-oriented, more high-tech, and in fact, global in nature. AIA believes that the modernized insurance marketplace would benefit greatly from a more uniform regulatory environment. The mere existence of more than 51 different regulatory systems needlessly adds substantial compliance and cost burdens to both insurers and consumers. Obviously, it's a very fluid state of financial services regulation in this country right now. Even today, Secretary Geithner has proposed new initiatives in this area. And obviously, there's an active national and even international discussion of this subject. I think it should be mentioned that the AIA's position in favor of an optional federal charter bears absolutely no reflection on the quality of insurance regulation in the state of Minnesota. AIA member companies have the highest respect for the job done by the Minnesota Department of Commerce. In essence, though, AIA does believe that financial rates form and financial regulation would benefit from uniform federal regulation. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. I'm sure we'll hear more on this topic as we move forward. Senator Scheid renews her motion that Senate file 1778 be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Committee on Rules. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion prevails. Senator Scheid, two more bills today. Senate file 1904 is next on our list.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Gross is here from the Department of Commerce to tell you why we ought to do this. It has to do with some COBRA provisions that are in the ARRA, which is the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. That's from this year, 2009. So I'll let him speak to why we should do this.
Mr. Gross, welcome to the committee.
Tell him what we're doing, too.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is John Gross. I'm with the Department of Commerce. Thank you, Senator Scheid. This is a very important bill for all Minnesota residents. As you may know, the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act provides COBRA premium assistance. 65% of that premium will be paid by the federal government for the individual employee who is involuntarily terminated from employment and also for their family members. And the federal law deals mainly with anybody that terminated their employment from September 1st, 2008 to December 31st, 2009. And under federal COBRA only deals with employers that have 20 or more employees. Minnesota law deals with employers that have two or more employees. And so where the little glitch is for we call it the additional election period or the look back. These are people that terminated their employment from September till now and never elected COBRA. They get a second chance to do COBRA, and because the federal law doesn't deal with those, we're just trying to make some minor amendments to our law, our COBRA law, to accommodate those people. So by passing this bill, this will help the people that want to have another second opportunity to elect COBRA. And I want to point out, we don't mention this in the bill here, but whatever money these people receive, in a sense, it's not going to be taxed. We also making sure that if you do the second election, there's no pre-existing, no concerns in it. You just have another opportunity. The employer or the insurer is the one that's going to be sending out these notices and taking care of all the funding for this. So it's really a tremendous benefit for the employee or the family that terminated their employment.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, I do need to offer a date change. We okay. want to have this expire later than the date on page 2, line 10, the last line of the bill. We would like to have it expire June 30th, 2010.
Okay.
And Mr. Gross can explain why.
Okay. Mr. Gross.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Tom Pender helped write this bill for the Senator Scheid and Representative Atkins, and he was concerned that maybe Congress might be doing some more changes to the program. So he suggested this. I've talked to the insurance industry, and they have some pros and cons on this, but I think I'd like to go with the June 30th, 2010 date. I don't think it's really going to have any major impact because this is only good for people that terminate and opt for this up until December 31st of this year. But again, if Congress makes some changes, then we're prepared.
Okay. Further discussion on Senator Scheid's amendment. Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. The amendment is adopted. Would anyone else like to be heard on Senate file 1904? Seeing none, Senator Scheid moves that Senate file 1904 as amended be recommended to pass and sent to the floor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion prevails. Senator Scheid.
Didn't need to go to the health committee. No, so we're fine.
Senate file 1761 is the last bill on our agenda.
And Mr. Chairman, this bill has to do with chemotherapy, and I think when we think of chemotherapy, we think of the kind that people receive intravenously, because that's been the typical way to receive chemotherapy. And what we have here and what's happening is that there are now new orally administered chemotherapies, anti-cancer medications that can destroy or slow the growth of cancerous cells. And we're finding that there it's difficult to have the kind of coverage for that people have for the traditional intravenous chemotherapy. And this bill says that if a health plan provides coverage for cancer chemotherapy treatment, that you don't require a higher copay, deductible, or coinsurance amount for a prescribed orally administered chemotherapy or anti-cancer medication, I should say, that's used for the same purposes as the traditional IV intravenous. So this is to keep pace with where science is taking us, and I don't think I handed out charts, but I can tell you this, that intravenous chemotherapy is usually, I think, covered under your medical benefit, the plan's medical benefit, but that what happens is that the pharmacy benefit is what takes care of that chemotherapy that's administered by a pill. And I just can tell you that, I mean, I think it makes perfect sense that if the purposes of the drugs are the same, whether it's in a pill form or in an intravenous form, that if the purpose is the same, it ought to be treated the same for coverage. So that's what this bill does. I think there is someone here.
We have a couple people. Mr. Aarons in the audience?
Yes, he is.
Okay. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is David Aarons, Director of Government Relations for the American Cancer Society in Minnesota. The American Cancer Society is the largest voluntary organization in the state and throughout the country of cancer patients, caregivers, and survivors, and loved ones who care about eliminating cancer in this country. I speak today in support of Senate File 1761. For several reasons. Up until now, the majority of frontline cancer chemotherapy treatments have been administered to patients primarily through an IV in the physician's office. The emerging oral chemotherapy drugs are the latest breakthroughs in advances in cancer chemotherapy. Most current cancer chemotherapies lack specificity, killing both cancer and normal cells, and cause unwanted side effects. Oral cancer chemotherapy drugs are designed to target specific cancer-causing molecules, eliminating cancer cells while avoiding serious damage to other non-cancerous cells. In a sense, members of the committee, oral cancer drugs represent a breakthrough in science. The function of emerging oral cancer chemotherapy drugs is no different than other cancer chemotherapy drugs. They're all used to destroy cancer. One of the things that makes oral cancer chemotherapy drugs unique is that they're being developed in an oral form only and do not have an IV equivalent. An oral form only and do not have an IV equivalent. Oral cancer chemotherapy drugs represent an exciting new development in frontline cancer therapy and show remarkable promise at targeting the tumor with limited side effects. As such, they are a critical option for many cancer patients. Since scientific advances have now provided us with new and even more effective treatments, we'd like to be able to make sure that cancer patients have access to these drugs at the same costs as they would traditional chemotherapy. Access to oral chemotherapy drugs has become even more important as these drugs become online and more prevalent. The American Cancer Society believes that there should be parity between the coverage of them with traditional chemotherapy so that cancer patients may be equally able to access and afford oral chemotherapy drugs as they can with traditional IV chemotherapy. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify in support of this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Aarons. Ms. Coleman?
Yes.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, again, Danette Coleman. I guess I'm on a roll here today. I will be very quick. I know time is of concern. I wanted to express some concerns we had with treating benefits differently based on a diagnosis rather or a condition rather than a service. Typically, the way that benefit contracts are written, you have certain benefits for an office visit, for a hospital service, for a drug benefit. So this deviates from that. I also wanted to clarify how these benefits are administered. As Senator Scheid mentioned and Mr. Ahrens mentioned, there are amazing new technologies in the treatment of cancer, and a lot of these oral chemotherapy drugs have fewer side effects and many benefits to them. They are also very expensive. Looking at the oral chemotherapy drugs in 2008, the top 10 that were submitted, the average price for that per prescription, which is typically 30 days, is $5,000. And so the way that many health plans treat this is they're treated as what's called specialty drugs. So they have a 20% coinsurance on them. However, acknowledging the financial impact of 20% of $5,000, for example, Medica puts a $200 cap on that. So regardless of the price of the drug, your coinsurance would be 20%, but the max you would pay per prescription would be $200, even if 20% would be $1,000. The other thing that I want to clarify is that the legislation would require that the copays deductibles on these drugs be no more than the intravenous drugs. In many instances, the intravenous drugs actually are more out of pocket because that benefit is paid for according to the place of service where you received the intravenous chemotherapy. So perhaps an office visit or outpatient hospital. So that then depends on your contract. There may be instances, there are not many of them left because of the cost of health care, but there are still policies that have co-payments, so a $30 co-payment. In that case, the intravenous drug would just have a $30 co-payment. But if you had a high deductible plan or a 20% co-insurance, the intravenous treatment would have a 20% co-insurance. And to give you an idea of the cost of that, for a standard chemotherapy, that can be about $500. There are new, again, amazing technologies around cancer, but very expensive. Avastin is a new cancer drug. To give an example, that's about $8,000 per treatment. And how many treatments you need depends on your condition and your situation. So, again, and in those benefits, that would be a 20% coinsurance. So that would be the same. The other thing I'd like to remind this committee is that in addition to the $200 cap out of pocket that we put on these drugs, everybody's contract has what's called a maximum out of pocket. So in a certain year, no matter how much health care service you used, you're going to hit a max where you pay out of pocket no more than that. And this is presuming you're in the network and receiving services that are eligible, of course. So just to give you a quick example of that, standard contracts have a $2,500 maximum out of pocket or up to $5,000 maximum out of pocket in standard policies. And so realizing here that, and I'm not at all to say $2,500 or $5,000 out of pocket is not a financial hardship for someone, but most individuals who are receiving cancer treatments end up hitting their maximum out of pocket of the $2,500 or $5,000. So there would be that additional protection that would be in place. And lastly, I would just like to say we, and I think that the American Cancer Society agree on that we need to do more to make sure these drugs are available as generics and that we can get generics to the market sooner so that the cost of these drugs are not an impediment to these life-saving and life-prolonging treatments. And with that, I would take any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Coleman. Any questions from the committee? Would anyone else like to be heard on Senate File 1761? Seeing none, Senator Scheid moves that Senate File 1761 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Health and Housing and Family Security Committee. On that motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? No. The motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Scheid. And thank you, committee members. That takes care of our work today. For the first deadline, I assume we'll meet again next week, Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, that's right.
Next Tuesday.
So we'll have meetings Tuesday and Thursday at least, and we're just getting ready to now look at that calendar and see what comes from the House. I think our corresponding committee in the House meets later today.
Okay, wonderful. With that, the meeting is adjourned.
Thank you.